you, sir, are?
Benjamin Hulse, Your Honor.
Okay, Benjamin.
For Box.
Hulse, good morning to you.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. Good morning, Justices of the Supreme Court. May it please the Court. As I said, I represent the appellant and appellee, Box. This is an appeal and a cross-appeal from the District Court's interpretation of a longstanding supply agreement between Box and Anderson. Box is the supplier of BP-branded gasoline, which means that it buys gasoline from BP, the big company, and then it turns around and it sells it to Anderson, who operates several stations, retail stations, in the Omaha area. And the stations fly the BP flag, as they say in the business, and sell BP-branded gasoline. And this agreement, there's a broader agreement, which is a purchase agreement coming out of 2007, to which the supply agreement is part. The broader agreement arises out of a bailout. Anderson had previously itself been a distributor, just like Box is. It got deeply in debt to BP, in over $800,000 in debt, and it also had a was looking to get deeper in debt through its own supply agreement. Box stepped in and bailed out Anderson. It did so by assuming the $840,000 obligation to BP. It assumed the rest of the supply agreement, and it also paid $300,000. And part of what it got in return is it got some properties that Anderson owned, and it got this supply agreement. And the supply agreement is distinctive and reflective of the extent of the bailout in that it is a perpetual supply agreement that is subject only to the unilateral termination of Box. Now, that said, Anderson still always has the remedies that a party has in a contract. It can terminate for a material breach, as it has the right to do. It can also assign its contract. The district court entered two orders on the party's cross motions for summary judgment. The parties had declaratory judgment claims. The claims arose out of Anderson's declaration to Box about 7 years, 8 years into the agreement, that it was going to do what's called rebranding. It was going to take down the BP sign, stop selling BP gas at its stations, put up Shell signs, and start selling Shell gas. And in the first of the two orders, the one that Box appeals from, what the district court did is it failed to apply the plain language of the agreement. It read the agreement to nullify key provisions that require specifically Anderson to operate the facilities in a manner that would actively promote the sale of Box branded motor fuels, that is, Box BP branded gasoline.
But no. It doesn't say anywhere you cannot rebrand, does it?
Well, Your Honor, actually, Section 6 of the, well, there are two places, Your Honor. Section 6 first requires Anderson to, quote, operate the facilities in a manner that actively promotes the sale of supplier-branded motor fuels. Supplier-branded motor fuels are defined to be the motor fuels that are supplied by Box, which are BP-branded motor fuels. Separately, Section 20B of the agreement expressly imposes an affirmative duty on Anderson to avoid any action which could justify Box's right of termination or non-renewal. Then under Section 36 says that Box may terminate or non-renew in the event that Anderson stops selling the branded fuel. So there's an affirmative duty not to do that.
The Section 36 refers to a franchise relationship. I mean, how does that relate here?
It does indeed, and the backdrop of this is the federal statutory regime, the Petroleum Marketing Practices Act. The Petroleum Marketing Practices Act governs supply relationships between gasoline distributors and gasoline suppliers. It doesn't come into the claims here, but it provides important context on the meaning of the terms. And a franchise relationship under the PMPA, as it's called, 15 U.S.C. 2801, subsection 2, simply defines the franchise relationship as the relationship between a seller of gasoline and a retailer of gasoline. Within the franchise relationship, then, is the franchise or the agreement itself. But there can't be any serious dispute under the PMPA, which again is the statutory backdrop which provides the terms that then appear in this agreement, that there is a franchise relationship between these parties. By federal law, there certainly is. And so
a franchise relationship between what? In what entity?
Yes, between Bucks, the supplier, and Anderson, the buyer, and also the retailer of gasoline.
And are you using that, you're saying that is a franchise relationship as defined in this federal act, as distinguished from other statutes which definition of franchise might differ?
Correct. In fact,
so this is a kind of a franchise light.
Right, and just a piece of background. So the PMPA is a federal statute, like a whole bunch of other federal statutes that were passed during the energy crisis in the 1970s, and it was guaranteed to ensure a stability of supply of gasoline to consumers. And it preempts state franchise laws to the extent there is a conflict between them. But one of the key things that it does is it provides certain defined terms, and one of the things that it says is, when you have a supplier of gasoline selling gasoline to somebody who then sells it to the public, that is a franchise relationship. And then the franchise, which refers to the agreement itself, then is part of the franchise relationship. The parties can have a franchise relationship without actually signing a written contract. But what the district court did here in construing the contract, and it relied on a rider to the supply agreement called the Electronic Dealer Delivery Plan. And what it did is it construed a provision of the rider, Section 12 of the rider, to trump the provisions that I've just referenced, Section 6.
It seems to indicate that Anderson could sell competitive brand products, does it not?
If you elide, Your Honor, the word herein. The point that we made into the district court and then on appeal is that the language here, the language that the district court relied on, it says, nothing herein shall obligate supplier to sell or subjobber to purchase products. Now, that language...
Under your interpretation, what purpose would that language serve? I mean, if we're construing both of these together and the agreements are to be construed together, Why point out that nothing in this part of the agreement would prevent you from selling competitive products?
Right, and it's because it's a separate agreement that governs very specific things. What it governs, for example, is the establishment of electronic payment and credit terms, and it also separately, that's the heart of it, it separately also says that Bucks doesn't have to sell gasoline to Anderson if it can't itself get supply. So this provision simply states that nothing in this agreement, that is the rider, is creating some obligation to buy or sell. The obligation to buy comes from the master agreement itself, the supply agreement. And when you think about the word herein is perhaps the most frequently used word by attorneys in the letter enclosed herein. Herein refers to the envelope that you're sending, not some other envelope. As Webster's Third International Dictionary, which is this court's probably most quoted dictionary, certainly the Supreme Court of the United States' most quoted dictionary, herein means in here, in this document, in this book. Herein refers to the EDDP itself. And when you construe the word to be limited simply to the EDDP rider, then everything makes sense and falls into place. The purpose of the agreement can be effectuated, which is the buying and selling of gas, and these obligations to not rebrand, the affirmative duty to not rebrand, and to operate and sell motor fuels all make sense. So under this court's long-standing precedent for contract interpretation, the Kluver case and so forth, the district court is supposed to give effect and meaning to the entire contract. What it did is it read the key provisions of the master agreement, the supply agreement, out of the agreement and let them be trumped by a misreading of the plain language of the EDDP rider.
Do you challenge the proposition that the two contracts should be read together?
We don't challenge that proposition that all of the contracts, including the purchase agreement, should be read together. However, they have to be read consistently with each other and according to the plain language. Also, briefly, I don't have much time left. We do think the district court should be affirmed on its second summary judgment order. We think that the court's finding that there was a unilateral right to terminate was consistent with Nebraska UCC Section 2309, subsection 2, and particularly comment 7, which, Your Honors, may I finish the sentence?
You may.
Which expressly allows for contracts of indefinite duration. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So Mr. Smeal?
Yes.
Good morning to you.
Good morning. Please, Court, Chief Justice, Counsel. Aaron Smeal on behalf of the appellee and cross-appellant, Ray Anderson, Inc. A couple of things I want to point out. First and foremost, this idea that there's a franchise arrangement between the parties under the PMPA, this is asserted for the first time, not at the trial court, not even on brief, right here today. It's the first time that's ever been asserted by Bucks. I just want to point that out. But I don't think that that really is, I just want the court to be aware of that. The reality, though, is that what Bucks is trying to say is that we take the subjobber supply agreement and we look at three different paragraphs, 6, 19, well, 4 actually, 6, 19, 20, and 36. And if we read all of those together and then we think about what they might mean or what they must mean, then we can write in a sentence into this agreement that doesn't appear there that says you have to buy BP-branded fuel. Then once we write that sentence into the subjobber supply agreement, that added sentence now becomes inconsistent with the EDDP. But you would have to not just read those together, you would have to misread those together. And I think it's important, if we look at Section 36 of the subjobber supply agreement, they rely heavily on this, and it says that we can terminate, as was pointed out, the franchise relationship. The agreement itself, capital A, defined term, agreement, remains right in that same paragraph 36. It says we can terminate the franchise agreement on 90 days notice. In all other respects, this capital A agreement will remain in place. So when we go back and we say, okay, under paragraph 19, if you do anything, you have an affirmative obligation to not do anything that would cause us to cancel this capital A agreement, you can't point to paragraph 36 because it specifically says selling other motor fuels doesn't give you a right to cancel the agreement.
But paragraph 36 gives Bucks the right to terminate something, right? And we can argue about whether it's a franchise agreement or the agreement as a whole, but it gives them some termination right.
Correct? That's correct. And so we want to read everything in a way that's consistent.
And if it gives them some termination right, then doesn't 20B place a duty on you and your client to avoid doing anything that would trigger that termination right? 20B speaks in terms of granting rights of termination and non-renewal. Then it doesn't specify the capital A agreement. It just says a right of termination.
Actually, it does, because it refers to the immediately preceding paragraph, subparagraph A, which is capital A agreement. So it is referring to the agreement when it says, when it's talking about an affirmative duty to take any action which justifies termination of the agreement. So, but looking at, I forget now where I was going with this. So in any event, yeah, looking at sub 20A, the right then is to, the obligation on Anderson is to not do anything that would cause the supplier to not renew this capital A agreement. And then paragraph B goes on to say, for the purpose of the foregoing, referring to A, and any statute governing termination or non-renewal, all provisions hereof put this affirmative obligation. So now, the other thing, though, is to look at, if we look at paragraph 6, section 6, the preamble after 6 points out what's really the franchise agreement is dealing with, and that's trade identities. And what the contract read as a whole says, essentially, is you have to protect our trade identities. We've created a brand, and we want to protect it. So you can't put, by way of example, Shell fuel in your tank and keep up your BP sign. You got to take down your BP sign. So we'll terminate the franchise agreement, meaning you can't have the BP sign anymore. The franchise arrangement ends. The balance of the agreement would remain. Now, why? I don't know why you would want to continue to be in the agreement if you're not buying fuel, but that's essentially how it works. So then we say, okay, if it's only permitted under the subjob or supply agreement to terminate the franchise arrangement, and we agree that the subjob or supply agreement makes no direct mention of an obligation to buy BP branded fuel. This is what the district court said. The district court said, there's some talk about ambiguity, and it's important because the district court did use the word ambiguous. And it's important to note not just what the court said, but what the question was at that time. Bucks was saying to the trial court, the district court, that the subdriver supply agreement creates an affirmative obligation on Anderson's part to buy fuel. And the trial court said, if that exists in the subjobber supply agreement, it's ambiguous at best. Even if it's there, it's ambiguously stated because we'd have to do what they ask you to do here today. Read all of this together and then draw in an obligation.
But if it's ambiguous, doesn't it become a question of fact?
No, and that's why I wanted to bring it up, because I think it's important. The court didn't say it was ambiguous. The court said, if there is an obligation on Anderson's part to buy fuel in this portion, the SJSA, it appears only ambiguously. So we look at the EDDP, which has unambiguous language that says you absolutely do not have to buy BP-branded fuel. You don't. In fact, and then it goes on to say specifically, you can buy other fuel. And then it goes on to say, if this is somehow inconsistent with the subdriver supply agreement, this language in the EDDP will control.
So that leads you to your proposition, we didn't do anything that would cause a termination.
Of the agreement.
Of the main agreement.
That's correct. We gave them the right to demand that the signs come down. We gave them the right to demand that you stop characterizing yourself as a BP station. That's the only right that they got, because we don't
and
have
that's
to...
That's how you interpret, provided there occurs no infringement of suppliers' branded trade identities.
Correct. Everywhere we look at the obligation to buy fuel, BP says, be careful, don't impair our trade identities. It doesn't say, you must have fuel in that tank supplied by me for all eternity, till the end of time. That's what they want you to read into the contract, to the agreement, but it's simply not there. So then how do we get around that? We say, well, how do we get around the EDDP saying, in absolutely unambiguous terms, they don't have to buy the fuel? Well, we say herein just means in the EDDP. But there's a preamble to the EDDP that says, this is incorporated in the overarching agreement. There's all kinds of language in the EDDP where when it wants to refer to itself, it does. It says this rider or this EDDP. When it wants to refer to the agreement, capital A, it says in the agreement. When it says herein, it doesn't limit to either one. And the contract demonstrates that it can do that when it chooses to. So herein, the only reasonable interpretation is that herein means the EDDP and the subdriver supply agreement together. And in fact, they say, read them together whenever you can. So we create an inconsistency by wrestling some obligation out of the subdriver supply agreement that doesn't exist there. So
where
then what
these,
we're left
where do these documents come from?
Who's
the author?
The author, I think, originally was BP. If you look, there's paragraph numbers are skipped and things like that. What's happened is that when Anderson and Bucks got into an agreement, old agreements that were written by BP were taken apart, reassembled, and put into here. It's all
these two documents are sort of cannibalized from some forms that BP originated. Is that
exactly
somehow
right.
Do we know this from the record?
Is this
a forensic examination of the
contract? No, I think that came up and was discussed to some degree at the trial court level. And so we're here really doing an autopsy on Frankenstein's monster, right? But who's Frankenstein? I don't know. But I want to talk about the termination. There is a unilateral right to terminate in this that's given to Bucks that says it's a unilateral right. First of all, it's important to note, it doesn't say a unilateral right to terminate in Bucks. It only says Bucks can terminate. Unilateral doesn't appear. It doesn't provide the same right to Anderson. It's silent. as to Anderson. It doesn't say Anderson cannot terminate. It doesn't say Bucks is unilateral. It's just silent. So the question then is whether or not we refer to the UCC for a gap fill. Well, obviously we have, I don't think there's any argument, in fact they've argued the UCC as well, that the UCC controls we have to sell the goods between merchants. The Nebraska Supreme Court said in Johnson Lake Development, you can have a unilateral right to terminate. And it referred to a number of other jurisdictions and other cases. But those are all distinguishable for one reason. Each and every contract that the court looked at in Johnson Lake had its own termination in it. Johnson Lake itself was a 30-year term with a one-year renewal at the end. But it had a term. All the cases that the Johnson Lake Court looked at outside of this jurisdiction that found the same thing all had terms. They were all leases, but they all had terms. If you go to the same jurisdictions, Illinois, Texas, and you look at the other cases from those same jurisdictions where there was not a termination date to the agreement, that it was open-ended and potentially perpetual, what the court said was either it can be terminated at will on reasonable notice, or in the alternative, essentially you go to the UCC. And here we have, remember, this is a UCC issue, and so the UCC would replace the common law. And so we have to build in a reasonable right to terminate, in our view.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? No, there is no time for rebuttal. The next case.